Okay. There was a lot of areas there where there was a lot of Japanese. I suppose they had life jackets on when swimming. All those little black dots you see are heads.
Oh, boy.
And they said to Yamashiro, when we hit it, this is what the experts say, when we hit it, it cut the thing in two, and mm-hmm. it sunk immediately. And with no survivors. In fact, the Japanese themselves says that there was no survivors. But some of the other ships, they were able, in fact, that's one of the lifeboats there. But anyway, we got credit for sinking it, and when you get credit for sinking it like that, you know, they paint the battleship on the torpedo tubes. Just to show you, even in calm weather, you scooped up water all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Now this right here, I won't put you to all this stuff, but where's my pen? Pencil. Anyhow, this was at a Christmas program anyway. That's me right there. Sitting on a torpedo tube. Okay. The Mariana Turkishute in the Surigao Straits, I think, was the largest operation we were involved in. I didn't go through this list and see what all they kept. They mentioned it, but where they come up with the 13, I don't know. I'm sure, you know, you lose track. I don't know. But at the end of the war, towards the end of the war, they had moved us up to Adak and Attu at the Aleutians.
Mm-hmm.
We were operating with carriers, and the carriers would go down close to Japan, and then our fighter planes would protect the B-29 planes that's coming up from Guam, Saipan, and Tinian.
Mm-hmm.
And when the war was finally over, when they dropped the first one, we knew about that. And then the Japanese sent a underling of some kind to the Philippines to talk to MacArthur, and he wanted a conditional surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And MacArthur didn't even talk to him, so they dropped the next bomb.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they dropped the two bombs. And because they weren't convinced, and on the History Channel there was a lot of the military people that decided they were going to fight to the end.
Mm-hmm.
See, they were great on this, if we can't win, we'll just kill ourselves.
Yeah. Oh yeah, but towards the end of the war, that's what they came down to, a lot of kamikaze.
Yeah, and when you get around to it, I'll get back to the kamikaze thing too. You want to do that now?
Just feel free, you know, if
okay,
you...
Okay.
I mean, if I don't cover something, George, just go right ahead.
The Japanese admiral that wrote a book about this said that none of the pilots were ever captured. Well, Mr. Admiral, there's one, and there's another one. I got one that's laying on the deck here somewhere. Oh, there's another one there. And they also said that they weren't teenagers. They were teenagers.
Oh, yeah.
And here's one that missed us.
Yeah, of course they don't want to admit defeat. You know, they don't want to admit.
Well, there's a sidebar story to that, too. One of the ones that the plane went down, he wasn't hit, I think. I think he just pancaked in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And as they picked him up and he turned toward the ship, he said, "Hi, Yanks, have you got any ice cream on this ship?" And what it was, he was going to UCLA, went home to visit his folks, and then the war got started.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and he told us all about it, he said, all this time I've been trying to get in somewhere I could get captured. And he said, "This, where you volunteered for this kamikaze thing," I said, "Oh, maybe this will work. If I can get in there without getting shot out of the sky,
mm-hmm.
and just land my plane there, somebody, knowing the Americans, they'll pick me up."
Yeah.
And so I suppose, of course, that was about maybe a year before the war was over, so he wound up in a plushy prison of war camp. So
oh, yeah.
The war was over for him.
Oh, he wanted to get out of the war. He wanted to quit.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, that's... Where he would have been going was better than where our prisoners of war would go.
See, the Germans, they course, they killed the Jews, the Gypsies, and anybody that disagreed with them. But at least the Air Force people that got taken capture in Germany fared. I've known several of them.
Mm-hmm.
They fared quite well. They got tired of cabbage soup. The Germans are big on cabbage soup because they had lost a lot of weight. But the Japanese, they starved their people and worked them to death by the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
I had one friend that was, he was captured in the Philippines. They took him to Japan. I didn't even know that Japan had an underground coal mine. But he worked in an underground coal mine the whole stinking war and never saw the sunshine.
Really?
Yeah. Jesse Miller was his name. He's from Moreland, Wyoming. And there's a guy here in Billings that teaches at Eastern. He used to. He's an artist. What is that guy's name? He was a friend of Jesse's, and he survived that death war, too. Can't even think of his name.
Yeah, I can't think. I don't think he works here anymore.
I'm sure he's retired now. Mm-hmm. But he is an artist also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they're... And particularly the History Channel has really zeroed in on that here lately, that when they built that big railroad over in China and they had all these people from England and from the United States and all over, that they worked to death.
So that's another thing. We already talked about Hollywood. How do you think the History Channel gets things right? I mean, do they get it right?
Well, they use the stuff they use and actually film.
Mm-hmm.
And no actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they say that these guys were nothing but skin and bones, you see the picture of it.
Yeah.
I guess you've got some people that don't even believe that the Holocaust happened.
Yeah, there are still people today that deny that the Holocaust even happened. It's amazing that...
It took some doing to stack 50... deteriorated bodies on a truck and take a picture of that many actors. I don't know how they did that.
I mean, the piles.
One of the things that General Eisenhower, he insisted that there were a lot of witnesses. Mm-hmm. He insisted that he told some of his tank commanders, I want everybody to come and see these. And they took a lot of pictures. Anyway, that's it.
I just want to make sure it's still running. Well, were there any real memorable experiences during combat that you had? I mean,
no, you're sitting there, and when the Japanese planes come your way, we had a 5-inch gun. That's 5-inch gun. It starts shooting with that, and then as they got closer, they start shooting with the 40 millimeter. When they start shooting with the 20 millimeter, you knew that they're right on top of you. And I got trained mostly at sea, on doing what you call fighter direction. We would get from carriers, or if we're close enough to land, we would get about 4 fighter planes. And see, if a Japanese plane was up high enough, we could pick him up 100 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
But if the kamikaze people learned that they got right down on the water and you didn't know they were coming until they were there. And we would, what we call vector, we would give the fighters a course and a speed and an altitude so they would come in over the top of the approaching Japanese things. And they were shooting them down by the dozens all the way through. We then later on in the war, and the Japanese wanted this real bad. They tried to capture somebody to learn and the Germans did too, how to fix this Buck Rogers shell. By Buck Rogers shell, it's a shell that is a 5-inch shell. If you shoot at a plane and it gets within 50 feet of any metal, it explodes, and it's enough. The Japanese planes were very fragile as far as getting hit is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And it got towards the end of the war, we could shoot one projectile at a Japanese plane that was in range and get him. And just there was no question. You just got him.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came up with the advantage of they call it fire control, but that doesn't mean putting out a fire. That means you're shelling control. Once our radar, we would transfer and hook it up to another antenna that was hooked to, so that everything that antenna looked at, the guns were all pointed in that direction without anybody doing anything except moving the guns. And boy, that was, that saved the day. And the only other thing that really saved our day is the Japanese didn't have sufficient radar equipment. Mm-hmm. They, the Surigao Straits, we always, everywhere we went, we zigzagged, because that would confuse the submarine, and he thinks he's going to know where we're going to be 10 minutes from now, and he wouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
They came up, I was watching it on radar. I was at battle station radar. I was watching it on radar. They didn't zigzag around, but they figured that, boy, we're going to go over there, and they were all prepared to shell our beaches up here, lady. Land troops right behind our troops, and that would have delayed the war probably a year had they succeeded in that. But they didn't succeed in that. And the thing is, our best radar equipment was invented by a Japanese who was at UCLA. He went back to Japan, and the Japanese, they didn't want anything to do with it. What's the principle is, it's the same principle that you see with TV antenna out in the country. Now they use this. What that does is, when you send out a radar beam, it will be wide, and it'll be wide, and this time it goes out just this little short piece, it will be narrowed.
Mm-hmm.
So you could zero in pretty accurately on a ship or a plane. And see, our ships and planes had a system called IFF, means Identification Friend or Foe.
Mm-hmm.
They had a thing that would beep out an International Mars Code that was changed every 4 hours, and we would know not to shoot at that ship or that plane.
Okay.
And, of course, the Japanese would have liked to have that also. So technology helped us shorten the war. Now, at the end of the war, we already had the operational schedule for the landing on the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And after we saw what mainland Japan looked like, interior, it was just one mass of underground caves and all that stuff, it would have taken an eye. And some of the officers and stuff on the History Channel said it would have taken 1 million lives on our side and 2 million lives on the Japanese side, and it would have taken 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And they would have fought practically the last man.
And when somebody, and I will forever be grateful to President Truman, he had the guts to say, let's save some lives and drop the big bomb. And of course, he's, a lot of the do-gooders have criticized him, but as far as I'm concerned, he was one of the best presidents we ever had.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest controversies then, and it's still a controversy now. And I mean, obviously, you have your feelings on that. And I mean, I feel the same way, that, you know, I mean, somebody had to do something about it, and he stepped up.
He did. Of course, Roosevelt didn't confide in him anything. He came in there cold turkey.
Mm-hmm.
But he had some good advisors that knew what was going on, and he was a quick learner, and he did it.
Mm-hmm. And the decision alone to drop even one of the bombs, I mean.
So you see, I have another story too. In 1950, even though I wasn't in the reserves, I got a notice to show up in Seattle, Washington, in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I was married, had two kids. Went to the family lawyer here, and I said, what in the earth am I doing? I'm not in the reserve. And actually, what's ironic about that, they're doing that now.
Mm-hmm.
They're calling some people up that long since. You notice when you see a picture of some soldiers over in Iraq, most of them got gray hair.
Yeah.
You don't see any pictures of any real young.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so I went to Seattle. They sent me down to San Diego. Well, at first I was going to be teaching in the same sonar school that I went through. But then they were activating some destroyers that they had put in mothballs. Mm-hmm. And I was assigned to a destroyer by the name of James E. Keyes. Well, I never did find it. Everywhere I went, it just left. And they flew me in an old propeller-driven DC-4 all the way from San Francisco to Tokyo. And I wound up going to the landing at Incheon with the Marines there because the destroyer was supposedly going to be in that area. And then mm-hmm. I wound up on a communication ship service by the name of Bayfield. But in the meantime, my wife had got a letter from the Secretary of the Navy with an apology. And I was on this Bayfield long enough that I finally got a letter from her.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I wrote a letter and said, my commanding officer, which I never was on, has instructions to send you to say you're a civilian in a war zone. So I was on this ship and we were evacuating the Marines that the Chinese were running out of North Korea. And another ship came along that was going to San Francisco, and I climbed down one of these nets and got on a small boat, went over to this ship, and it wound up in San Francisco. And there's more to the story than that. When you're married, you get a salary, but your wife and however many kids get a subsistence check. Mm-hmm. Well, I finally got discharged, even though I wasn't in, on the 29th of, I think, of January. And they had some kind of goofy rule that unless you completed the month, that your wife and kids didn't get any money. But they went ahead and paid it.
Yeah.
But I got a letter from them saying, you owe us $369. So I went to the family lawyer again, and the accountant says, what am I going to do with this? Well, if you don't pay it, they'll probably garnish you your wages or do something stupid. And I says, why don't you try, you're going to laugh at this next statement, why don't you try to make some payments? By then I'm up to here in it,
yeah.
In this Navy thing. So I started sending in $2 every month. And I sent in $2 every month until I paid that $369 off, so I got even.
Oh, boy. Every month.
And no interest. They didn't have any interest or anything. Just paid them $2 a month. I could have paid them more than that, but I was mad.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's amazing that they would make you pay it back after it was their error.
But one of the things about going back then, I saw, of course, in Japan, even though this was 1950, the war was over in 46, they really hadn't gotten around to repairing all the bomb damage that mm-hmm. we did. And I went by train, it was 2 days and two nights from Tokyo to Sasebo, where my ship had been and just left.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went on the battleship Missouri for a while, too, while I was there. But anyway, our bombers did a big job. I mean, they destroyed those Navy bases and stuff.
That was everything. Factories, Navy bases.
Oh, yeah. I've always been a fan of General MacArthur. A lot of people didn't like him. So, but when he decided to begin to treat the Japanese like human people instead of the way they treated everybody mm-hmm. else, and he set up a constitution and a government, and we shipped him a lot of wheat and food and they wound up there, probably our best friends we got in South Pacific.
For sure. They definitely changed for the better compared to where they were 60 years ago.
But according to the History Channel, there was a group of Japanese officers that didn't want the, what do they call it, the Imperial? No, what's the word for the head? Japanese?
The Emperor.
Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently, he had taped this surrender thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they had hid it somewhere where these Japanese officers were trying to find it to destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
They knew once that thing was played, then they were surrendered for sure. But surrendering was one of the best things. The standard of living of the Japanese has grown so much.
Oh, for sure. I mean,
yeah.
Evolution-wise, I mean, they're better off. Definitely better off. Let's see what we got left here. Well, we're going to take a few steps back here. Where were you when you heard the war was over, heard the news?
I was in the northern Pacific, about 300 miles from Japan, along with the carrier group.
Let's see. How about victory in Europe? Where were you when you heard of the victory in Europe?
You know, I don't remember. What was the date of that? Early 45?
I think it was April 45.
I remember picking up on the radio the landing, when they first landed in France there.
Mm-hmm.
April of 45. We were probably in the North Pacific mm-hmm. at that time too, still there. I remember there began to be, we were beginning to see some troop ships and stuff hauling some military people from Europe to that part of the world.
How did that make you feel, knowing that you guys were going to be getting the extra surplus of men to continue the fight with the Japanese?
It was a good feeling because the majority of the military and supplies and everything was going to Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. War in the Pacific was secondary to war in Europe. Yeah.
Even though I think our Navy in the Pacific was more than the Navy in the Atlantic.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Because once they sunk the Bismarck, and the British pretty much took care of the rest of the German Navy,
mm-hmm.
except the submarines. See, the British are the one that discovered the sonar equipment. My first school I went to, which was the instructors, the tape instructors, were mainly British people.
Mm-hmm.
Only our technicians improved it greatly from what they had. Theirs only had a range of just a short distance, and our sonar equipment could reach out to a little over 2,000 yards.
Mm-hmm. That's still a good distance.
Yeah. And you could, with experience, you could tell what you're hitting. As an example, when you get into a field of porpoises, they're everywhere. Their tail moves so fast it sounds like a small boat.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to determine that, and every once in a while you would get a Doppler off of a whale. And of course they're saying now that we shouldn't do that because it messes up their hearing thing on the East Coast. They're practicing sonar on the East Coast, and they want them to move out of there because they're, some of those whales, their hearing thing is messed up and they've been washing up on shore and stuff.
Oh, okay.
But it's just a sound thing. It's mm-hmm. nothing else. There's no atomic, there's no electrical, and all it is that electrical impulse causes a sound to go out, and then you have an electrical impulse receiver tells you what mm-hmm. it did when it went out there. So, of course, now the sonar equipment has a screen. We did it on our machine. We could tell the direction,
mm-hmm.
and you could tell the size because you had a blip on the screen, and you could roll the thing over to that blip and that would give you the distance. And then you could plot the submarine speed and direction and all that stuff. And that's why we were able to cut across, and by the time we got over here, we were right on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
We could shoot off depth charges. Oh, there's one part of this thing I didn't tell you. It's kind of interesting, too. We could drop depth charges from the stern, and we had the type that you could shoot off to the side on each side. When they first built us, we had an airplane on it.
Yeah, I read that.
An OS-2U Kingfish. Well, it was good. We could shoot it off. A Caterpillar, we could shoot it off real good because they could crank it out. And, of course, we were always rolling, and when we would be to a point of pointing up, they would shoot it off. But to pick it back up, it had to land in the water and then come on and hook onto a sea sled. That's just what woven rope, and then we would pick it up. But we were forever picking it up, and the ship's doing this, and just as we get it out of the water, whammo, it bangs it against the side of the ship.
So oh,
just
okay.
The idea was good. It was looking for submarines and also to direct shore fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so they pulled us back into Pearl Harbor, and they, to have that Caterpillar, we lost a couple of guns. We you know, there was more guns here and torpedo tubes. We lost the torpedo tubes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course, now where's the picture of after, see, that's, no, I thought the boat was on that. There's a picture of after there. Anyhow, it was just a standard. Oh, yeah, I know how I can do this. They came out with a book showing all the Fletcher-class destroyers, and ours is shown in there, but I don't know if it shows with the airplane on it or not. I thought I figured where the halibut. No, that's with the plane on it. There's the halibut there.
Oh, okay.
But somewhere there's a picture here without the caterpillar.
That's the exact same picture that's on here. Yeah.
Somewhere there's a picture without.
Yeah, it's interesting that they put that Kingfisher right on the ship like that.
It was a, it carried two people, a kind of a tail gunner and a pilot. Big pontoon in the middle and little ones on the wingtip. And the pilot just hated it because it could only go about 150 knots at a steep dive.
Mm-hmm.
And he hated it. But we kept it, I think, about a year. I can't remember exactly. Anyhow, we got home. I was home once for 10 days for repair at Maryland Navy Yard and out of San Francisco. And from 42 to 46, I had one 10-day leave.
Mm-hmm.
And got to go home. So, it was a long war.
One 10-day leave, that's amazing.
From 42 to 46, yeah.
So even while you were out at sea, didn't have a chance to go to a, did you ever land at all? Go on mainland?
One time we went, after the Guadalcanal thing was over, they sent us to Sydney, Australia, which mm-hmm. is not all that far. And we were there for 3 days. And of course you have to keep one third of the crew aboard all the time. So mm-hmm. I had 2 days off. We basically just rented a hotel room and we parked by what they call Hyde Park, and you can just walk right over there, and there's the downtown Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, that they always show you a picture of this theater thing there that wasn't there then.
Oh, okay.
And what was strange about that, instead of them going to town and getting drunk, and they brought big cans of fresh milk on mm-hmm. board, and we just stood around and drank milk. We hadn't had any milk in years.
Yeah. Milk, I mean, definitely if you've been out at sea like that for a couple years without milk. I mean, what was that like? What was the rationing like on board the ship?
It was, if we had enough supplies, everything was pretty much frozen. If we'd run out of supplies, then we would eat sea rations.
Mm-hmm.
As we got operating close to Australia, we got a lot of Australian mutton, they call it then. and you can make stew and whatever. They found out that sea rations had no nutrition to them. So when I got out, I basically had to have fillings in all my mouth. They're all still in my teeth. But I was suffering from malnutrition. I weighed, when I went in, I weighed 160 pounds. When I got home, I weighed 120.
Really? That's...
Now, I've lost weight again now. Kind of runs in my family when you get up to our age. My dad, my old, my brothers, I weigh 125 now.
Mm-hmm.
And I eat good. I'm married to a very good cook, and I eat well. But I've just sticked at 125. And I'm 80 years old.
That's amazing. I mean, about 40 pounds that you lost in the war.
And it was mostly fatigue. And a lot of times when you're doing certain things, like if you're doing shore bombardments, you load ammunition all day and fire all night, or you load ammunition all night and fire it all day. And we would go for weeks at a time that we averaged 2 hours sleep every 24, and you get so exhausted that when you lay down, your eyelids don't want to go shut.
Yeah.
They just don't want to go shut. You shut them, and I've got to sleep. If I don't sleep now, I'm going to be dead tomorrow. A lot of times, no sleep.
So getting only about 2 hours of sleep a night, how'd that affect your performance?
I don't think
especially in the sonar radar.
I don't think it affected that much because you had one goal in mind, and that was to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you see, when you're on a man of warship like a destroyer, you don't operate in friendly waters. You're already operating in enemy territory. Mm-hmm. And the longest, and I think it listed in here, the longest we went down kind of not even seeing land, I think it said 72 days. I couldn't remember how many days it was. I happen to see it in here. I think it was 70. We were with a carrier force, and with a carrier force you had an ammunition ship, a food ship, and a tanker.
Mm-hmm.
See, we operated off of old, non-usable diesel fuel. It was steam turbine engines. We had two 60,000 horsepower steam turbine engines. We could do 47 knots, which is basically 54 miles an hour. Of course, at that speed, nobody's on the deck here or anything. You'd get washed overboard because instead of going over a wave, you cut through it.
Mm-hmm.
And the most, I think the most time I was really fearful of not really coming home, just before we got to the Philippines, and they really blamed Admiral Causey for this, there was a terrific hurricane. And the History Channel said, here you would be, you'd be in a kind of a trough, and here's a huge wave up here.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was about 45 feet. So there's a while that there's waves on both sides of it, and you think, well, if they ever come together, they're just going to get you.
Yeah, I'm just going to swallow it up.
But, of course, when the waves come in, then it just raised the ship up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the History Channel said the swells and the carriers lost a lot of airplanes because they rolled over so much, even being tied down the way what they did, just slid off. And he could have gone around that and didn't. And that's, the historians are saying, his two big blunders, that was three blunders. One was, the first one was letting the Japanese take all those people prisoners on Wake. The other one was this typhoon. The other one was that while we were battled down on Surigao Straits, our ships over here that they were supposed to protect, he took off after a dummy fleet and followed him, but then he got back, we lost several carriers and
mm-hmm.
stuff. And those guys like that, they got an ego thing. Of course, this is top echelon as far as officers are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted, it's kind of like presidents, they wanted a something in their history book about how great a job they did.
Oh, yeah.
And so wanting it so bad, he screwed up bad time, big time, twice, three times.
Of course, being charged like that, you have to have an ego.
I suppose. Admiral Fletcher was our main admiral in most of these operations, and his thing was, we're going to win with the loss of as few people. If we have people in danger, we're going to rescue them.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt secure with him. He was just a dandy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Halsey, he was basically with the aircraft carriers, and Kincaid was basically with surface ships. And I'm sure he was very displeased that Halsey took off like that, because he lost a lot of people. But the kamikaze thing killed more U.S. Navy people than anything else did. When you look at the loss of materials and gas and human lives and cities, wars are a terrible thing.
Oh, yeah.
They just are. I don't know what you got to do. You got to defend yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't defend ourselves, look at what those countries went through, where the Japanese and the Germans took the blow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You got to defend your livelihood, your way of life.
Even besides the fact that they haven't found any weapons of mass destruction, they know that he had them. They had them when they permitted the first thing. Nobody seems to know where they are, but I would bet a month's pay that all that stuff got hauled to Syria or Iran, and that's where it still is. But that's my story. I'm stuck with it.
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back. Go back to the depth charges.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? I mean, those had to be massive explosions. I mean, searching for those submarines like that.
Well, you had two options. Well, you had the main option with them: are you close enough to the submarine? The other option is, what approximately is his depth? Because you could set a thing on each one, and the big ones on the stern was about like a 60-gallon barrel. They were big and heavy. The ones that got shot off to the side, they were about half that size. But we don't know how many submarines we sunk. We shot at a lot of them. I know one of them that we hit wound up ashore at Guam. It surfaced, and we basically drove it ashore there. Well, there was people. There was people on shore that took over from there. And when we stopped there, when I was on the way to Korea, and the little thing still sitting there, it's pretty much just a big chunk of rust now. But they never did move it.
That's interesting. I mean, not even for scrap purposes.
No. Oh, the Halford. They activated it during the Korean War, but I never did see it, of course. And then according to the history, later on it was sold to Gillette Razor Company.
Really?
And it made ballpoint pens. And I think it says that here. Oh, and in May 1st of 1968, no, wait a minute. They sold it for scrap on the 2nd of April, 1970. But I had told some of the guys that was on shift that when we have reunions, that they said that somebody told them that Gillette Razor bought it.
That's interesting. It's a
ballpoint pen.
It's a ballpoint pen.
You might
somewhere
be shaving with a halberd.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing with scrap metal, you know. It's amazing its uses, what it goes into. I mean, using an old ship for ballpoint pens, razors.
Well, you see, back then there was no, didn't have much aluminum and no stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
So a big constant problem is holding down a brush on your whole ship hull and and everything that was like guns and stuff on the top side, because you're constantly in salt water.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing. It being out in the salt water like that, what kind of precautions, what kind of things would people on the ship do to make sure that, you know, guns wouldn't rust, holes wouldn't rust? I mean, would you have to
paint, scrape and paint?
Did you ever personally have to do
anything? No, one of the things about going into a specialty school right out of boot camp, you're not part of what they call the deckhands. The deckhands did all of that. They took care of all the boats, lifeboats, and the maintenance of, well, the upkeep of the ship, not the maintenance of it, because you had specialties for steam boilers, and you had specialties for electrical system throughout the thing. So, I'm tempted to tell you something else, and not everybody knows about it, but I'll go ahead and tell you that. And taking physicals, they decided I had something wrong with one lung. And they sent me to a specialist here in, at St. Vincent, did a CAT scan. And he determined that I have asbestos poisoning. Why I never asked him this, but why it took that long to show up, I don't know. But you see, on a ship, you're surrounded with asbestos because all the insulation on the hull is asbestos. All these steam pipes is running everywhere. It's covered with asbestos. I should have asked him. I said, well, that's a long time ago. What am I doing with that? I don't really know what they're going to do about it, if they're going to do anything. He said, you've got two options, and one is to let it go and watch it, and the other one is to take a bunch of tests. But he said, if you do a bunch of biopsies and stuff like that, you're going to stand a chance of making it worse. But I have good stamina. I'm not short of breath. I don't know, but I guess I say this for one reason. There's still a lot of people that came from World War II.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, our soldiers, I mean, go back to the atomic bomb being dropped on Japan. I mean, they're still having some problems with the radioactive effects. And so, even though it was 60 years ago, it's a far-reaching effects.
Well, see, we were about 300 miles from Japan, and east of Japan, and the predominant winds are from the west. There was one thing, and when they went to Korea, they put me on a train, and we went through that whole area where the atomic bombs were dropped, and nobody thought anything of it.
Really?
Yeah. They didn't. They hadn't gotten around to knowing about the radioactive problem. Well, not entirely.
So, being 300 miles offshore, when the bombs were dropped, were you able to see?
Didn't see
any of it, no.
We heard about it over our special radio thing, and we, in those early days, we weren't sure just where they dropped it and stuff. And they would kind of keep us up through, what do they call the radio hookup for the military in World War II? There was a name for it. Can't think. But anyway, we could pick it up with our radio direction finder. And I don't think they had, it wasn't until they started dropping atomic bombs on some of our older ships down there in some of the islands down there did they really realize the fallout problem. You would have thought we could have seen in 300. Of course, when you're on the ocean, you really realize the earth is round. See, to see a ship with a 100-foot mast that's coming towards you, you don't see that until they're 20 nautical miles.
You just kind of see the mast.
And at first you see the mast, and then you begin to see more of the ship as it gets closer to you. You really realize you really can tell, it's kind of like the astronauts, they really tell the Earth is round. Mm-hmm. There ain't no question.
Yeah. for sure. Let's see what we've got here. Well, I guess we can end the war there for you. What were your expectations once the war ended?
Didn't know what would happen. Here was all these military people coming back to the States. I had no expectations.
Since you were a volunteer, were you expecting to be discharged immediately, or did you still have time left to fulfill?
We got back to Bremerton, Washington, and we came down from Atunadak down to Kodiak, and on down to Juneau, and we were at Juneau on Navy Day of 1945, I guess it was, yeah, okay. I had enough points to get out before that. I thought, well, I might as well just stay on ship. At that time, we were signing surrender for Northern Honshu and Hokkaido in Japan. And then we came back for Navy Day to Juneau. Then we came on back down to Seattle and Bremerton. Mm-hmm. And that was in October. Well, I was to be discharged at the Naval Air Station in Memphis, Tennessee, but all the troop trains were so full, I just stayed aboard ship. Because
mm-hmm.
it was still active, we still had the cook and the crew, and we were just tied up there in Bremerton, Washington. Well, you were pretty free to go and come as you want, because, you know, several of us would go into Seattle most every night and stuff. So one night we went to Bing Crosby's brother, I think, but had a band there and stuff. Went to a band concert mm-hmm. there, and I met a girl there, and we visited and stuff and like that. And then I started coming in about every night, and we would go to a movie or go eat at Ivor's or something. And a year later, I married her. And that's 59 years ago.
Wow.
but I didn't get passage on a railroad until about the 4th of January from October the 20th in Juneau to